The life of a streamer. Eventually, like, I need to, cash out all my LBC and just buy a decent desktop computer with like rad specs and get everything going. But just I gotta pump the token too, which is the topic of today's conversation, right? We're gonna talk about how you're gonna tell us all why we should buy the LBC token, how to do so,
Oh
and what
man.
guarantees that gives us. Of course.
I know. I know you're trolling.
It's fun. It's fun to do.
Yeah, I don't have to tell me.
Yeah. Oh yeah, of course. The troll in chief and stuff. All right, we'll wait till you add a couple of people on at least the YouTubes. And let me open up the Odyssey one. Do you have anything? It's funny how like it says we have three on Odyssey, which is nice. It's funny how like the Odyssey view counts are kind of like all over the place. Like sometimes I have like half like my audience or like or maybe like 20, 30 people even on Odyssey sometimes. And then other times it's like one or two. It's kind of,
Yeah.
yeah. Well, I mean, you share the Odyssey link. I mean, if you're not gonna, if you can't b bring in your own faithful, then I don't know what's gonna work. But yeah, so we should currently have like way more people on Odyssey than anywhere else. This is a good time to just run the intro and we'll just jump into life. Oh, so hey everyone, welcome to another episode of Digital Cash Rundown. I now have a guest back. I'm joined by the one and only Jeremy Kaufman, who when we started the show was not there. He's reaching for something, probably hydration. It's okay, I won't hold it against you. How's it going, man?
It's great to be here with you, as always.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, I mean, you're quite the busy man for good reasons and maybe some like dubious reasons, but not your fault. So, yeah. We have a lot. So before I get going on this stuff, if you're watching on YouTube, which you are, whoever you are, it's one person right now. I won't be butthurt if I that number goes down to zero, but only if you go over to Odyssey. We're live streaming on Odyssey. In the description on the YouTube and Twitter and everything else, like there is the Odyssey link. So you click there. I encourage everyone to watch on that thing. Might as well stress, Jeremy's servers out a little bit more. Get all that in there. So that's just like the big thing. That and you can also leave Hyper chats on Odyssey, and you can use cointr.ee slash the desert links, leave other crypto zero chats. Oh, hey, one time. Anyway, let's just run into the stuff going on. So, there's a an article about your good old buddies, your besties, the SEC, the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, reportedly contracts blockchain analytics firm to monitor the DeFi industry. So essentially, the SEC is, reportedly signed a $125,000 deal, which isn't that much money as far as things are concerned, but it's not like 40 grand to just look at something, to just help monitor, to with a and chain.ai to help monitor the DeFi industry and essentially just see what everyone's doing. So I see by your look, you got a hot take before we
I
get into too
do.
much nuance,
I
but
do. I
go for
do.
that.
Yeah. You want, yeah. I mean, my hot take, that's of course the correct take, is that these people are collaborators. Okay. These people are the enemy. The whoever is working at on-chain, and I think the guy's name was Victor Fang. I pulled up the article that you sent me shortly before I
Yes.
joined the gym. And like, it's not okay to be doing this kind of thing. If you work at that company, you should quit. The SEC is trying to destroy the industry. They are very anti-blockchain. Most of several branches of the federal government are. And so, this isn't an okay thing to do this. It's not okay for the people who work there to do this. Companies should not hire people who have worked at firms that did this. Okay, like they the SEC and these other government agencies, they are destroying good people's livelihoods through violence. And so like to support that I think is unconscionable. And so like that should be the attitude that people in the blockchain industry have towards this kind of behavior.
Well, that's definitely you know, a scalding hot take. I can't really say I disagree with anything there. But now I got to put on my John Stossel hat and, like, you know, the, but isn't it unfair that people make money and all that kind of stuff? Well, shouldn't they be regulating illegal securities? So, like, what if, and this is the thing, another one of the SEC commissioners, I forget which one, I don't care to memorize their names, said something about how a lot of DeFi firms or whatever, it's not DeFi, it's really CeFi, they call DeFi. They're literally just, you know, offering securities, but not complying with securities laws. And it's just one enterprise that's doing it, and they call themselves decentralized, but they're not, and that those people should be regulated and stuff like that. So,
yeah, well, so I agree in terms of the take that some of DeFi is more like CeFi. I actually agree with that, but that doesn't change the fact that these are people who are voluntarily trading goods and voluntarily engaging in these services. So whether even if it's CeFi, that's not an excuse. And also, you know, the securities regulations, decentralization is not part of the standard. That's not actually, you know, a lot of the people in the crypto space latch on to this concept of, like, decentralization versus centralization. That's not a key part of the securities tests. If you look at the, you know, the Howey test as an example, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't, decentralization versus centralization, that's not actually a part of it. But, you know, more importantly, I would say that, like, there is a defense of some of these government agencies, right? But that defense is that they should be investigating fraud. They should be investigating when people are defrauded and when people are cheated. Mm-hmm. And there are bad actors in the blockchain space. I wouldn't dispute that. Okay. But what should be motivating that is people saying, I was taken advantage of. I was cheated. Someone lied to me. You know, someone took my money and didn't deliver what was promised. Someone broke a contract. These are the kinds of things that should, you know, motivate this kind of action for the government to be, you know, unilaterally investigating these things. And, you know, in the case of us, we have millions of people. Not a single person has gone to the government and they're investigating us anyway. It's crazy. It's no different than the war on drugs. Okay. We shouldn't, the government should not be, going after peaceful people who are doing things voluntarily.
Yeah. I mean, I completely agree on that thing. Now, we're going back to the devil's advocate thing. So we know the SEC is just trying to find anyone who can put, who could be considered, or that they can find a way to consider to be violating securities law and, you know, screw them over. Of course, you know what they're doing. But in the devil's advocate sort of world, and we are talking about the devil here, let's be very clear, what if the monitoring is just to see who is DeFi, who is actually CeFi, for when there is someone who says, oh, I got screwed by so-and-so DeFi outfit, and the SEC is like, hey, guess what? Good thing we know that they're not actually DeFi, they're CeFi, so now we know an actual perpetrator be brought to justice when they actually defraud someone. Again, we know that this is not what the SEC is going to actually do, but what do you think about the case for a firm like a outfit like the SEC monitoring the blockchain in for these kinds of purposes?
Well, DeFi is not a non-fi. Like, again, I think there's this emphasis on decentralized versus centralized is a bit misleading. And also I'll say, anytime you're going to a website, it is not decentralized.
Yeah.
You know, pretty much the only decentralized, you know, I haven't done a deep dive on all of these, but, you know, something like BISC, you know, that appears to be actually decentralized. None of these, you know, pancake swap, you know, sushi swap, whatever all of these are, they're websites, which means they're by definition not decentralized. Okay.
Yeah.
Odyssey is not decentralized. We don't claim that Odyssey is decentralized. Odyssey interacts with a decentralized network. That's true. Right. But Odyssey itself is not decentralized. So, you know, and this is, once you're saying go to a website, you know, you're basically saying that it's not decentralized. But even if these ones were decentralized, even if it was literally like a peer-to-peer app,
yeah,
the government can still go after you because the government can identify who built the software. And, you know, building the software that you know, encourages or facilitates certain type of activity is, I don't know all the laws in the space, but is, like, at least possibly in and of itself, against the law, right? And we've seen, you could look at, this is from a previous generation, but all the lawsuits around peer-to-peer software, where, you know, it was found that these people broke the law despite the fact that they were not directly, you know, with their servers and with their infrastructure serving the infringing content. So, you know, simply building the software that does it can, in the government's eyes, be sufficient.
So on a broader scale, right, we're talking obviously about like what's right and what's wrong, what should or shouldn't happen, all that kind of stuff. But now we're talking about, okay, this is what's happening. What do you think are the effects of something like this? Do you think it's going to cause, first off, do you think it's going to squash the DeFi space? Do you think it's going to cause the DeFi space to stop being posers and actually be more decentralized, so they're harder to actually suss out and crack down on? Do you think it's just going to move everything out of the US? What do you think is going to happen as a result of this kind of stuff?
Yeah, well, the US, you know, moving outside of the US, I think, can maybe delay it, but it doesn't end it. The United States government is happy to enforce its agenda abroad. And so if the United States government takes the stance that something is illegal, you know, you better not come anywhere near the US. I mean, you don't even necessarily need to come into the US. You're just a year or two ago, right? The US arrested that that Chinese telecom executive in Canada, saying that they broke US law. It was never on US soil. Everything they did was in Canada and China. And they said, you've broken the US law. And they apprehended him in a Canadian airport, or maybe it was even a woman. But anyway, so like even that, I'm not sure is sufficient. I will say that, like, generally, what is that? It's like one of Taleb's rules. Mm-hmm. I guess it's like just the general principle of anti-fragility, that like things that don't destroy something are going to make it stronger a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. So even if some of this stuff sets it back, if the response from the industry is to evolve the way that they do things, then ultimately the resulting thing will be stronger and more resilient to disruption. And the more that it does force things onto designs that are sort of more authentically decentralized. And I will also say that, like, decentralization versus centralization is a continuum.
Mm-hmm, of course.
And so it's, you know, like, it's a part of that when you're saying this is centralized or decentralized is kind of saying, like, where along this continuum do you want to apply the label? Mm-hmm. And I will say that, like, sometimes when we have these debates as to whether or not something is decentralized or centralized, we may actually agree on the sort of reality, on the territory of how the actual networks work. And we may just disagree on what centralized versus decentralized mean. You may have a standard that says, yeah. So yeah, but that is a point, because I think that's a big argumentative trap. If something is or is not X, and what we're not actually disagreeing on reality. We're just disagreeing on, like, how those labels are applied.
Yeah, for sure. Specifically with like the decentralized thing. I don't think there is a single thing that's entirely decentralized in the entire world, really, like, fully. And I also, a lot of things, it's just like decentralized enough to where if the largest people operating a thing get attacked, the big figures get attacked or taken down, the whole rest of the stuff keeps running. It's kind of like where I would draw the line type of a thing. Like, for example, if Library Inc. got shut down or whatever, and then obviously Odyssey would go down. But people would still be running Odyssey on, you know, clients and stuff. And that would be, I mean, they'd be running Library on the actual desktop client. And it would still be doing videos, still be like functioning kind of. So I would consider that to be a decentralized network at that point. Wouldn't you?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. I think, you know, to me, we're certainly over the line. And I think we'd be over the line for just about anyone's standard.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's for sure. And I have to say, like, as much as crap as I've gotten Bitcoin over the years for being, you know, in the pocket of Chinese miners kind of thing, after the whole mining debacle thing, and then most of the hash rate just got taken out because of China, it still works. I mean, if I don't know if you call what it did before working, but you know what I'm saying? And it still did the thing it was doing before. And so, yeah, I guess you could call that semi-decentralized at least, right?
Yeah, the service that Bitcoin provides is very resilient. And I actually think by pretty much any standard, you know, I think Bitcoin is very decentralized. I guess if you're going to attack, like, maybe the way that, like, development happened or something, but even there, the fact that, you know, probably no network has seen more forks from third parties who want to, well, third parties, everyone's a third party. Well, I don't know. I don't actually, I should understand this.
Fourth parties.
Yeah. You know, someone's got the keys to the Bitcoin Core code base that's generally regarded as the code base. Yeah. And so to some extent, like, they are something like a first party. Like, I agree that it's true that no one has to listen to them, right? So if they try to commit something or try to push a change that people don't like, people aren't locked into it. Mm-hmm. But there is a different status between whatever party, and I don't know if that's Blockstream or who exactly it is, but whatever mm-hmm. party controls the main repos that are identified as, hey, this is actually Bitcoin Core, you know, they have some additional status.
Yeah. And of course, there's structural decentralization versus practical. So for example, Litecoin is structurally decentralized, I guess. But then what can be done with Litecoin without Charlie Lee's, you know, gold stamp of approval? Like, what happens to the coin if he disappears? Oh, that's a little more, you know, a little trickier.
Yeah. Litecoin is one of the more confusing products to me.
Yeah.
I don't know, like, what. I don't see anyone actually using it. I don't really understand why anyone cares about it. And I don't understand what it's doing. That's interesting, you know?
Yeah, it's like Dogecoin minus the memes, sort of.
Yeah.
Which is, right. I don't know. I could.
Right, but the meme is all that Dogecoin has, right? And actually, yeah. At least in Dogecoin, like, there's an argument that they're saying, hey, actually, continual inflation is good, mm-hmm. right? There is a logical defense of that stance, you know? Mm-hmm. And so there is at least, hey, Dogecoin is saying, hey, you know, we're like Bitcoin, but we are going to continue to inflate because we actually think that's a desirable property of a cryptocurrency.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we could go into that all day, and obviously I could dump on Litecoin all day. I really like to do that, but let's move on to Cuba, right?
Yeah.
Cuba, the bastion of liberty, is set to recognize and regulate cryptocurrency. Essentially, they're going to come up with a regulatory framework for cryptocurrencies being used for payments and things like that, and distribute licenses and stuff like that. And yeah, basically, I don't know, take your hot take first.
Well, it wouldn't be Cuba without licenses. You know, so it gets into the specifics. You know, are they really trying to accept it, or is this actually a scheme to, you know, subvert it or hurt it? I'm not claiming that it is. It's actually logical, like, for countries like Cuba, mm-hmm. for countries that are sort of like the most opposed to the current, let's not even say it's the United States hegemony. Let's say that it's sort of like the current central banking hegemony or the current, like, you know, monetary hegemony, which expands beyond the United States.
Yeah.
Like, the countries that are most opposed to that mm-hmm. are the countries that it makes the most sense to sort of be adopting these blockchain style approaches, whether this is a genuine embrace of the technology versus an attempt to, like, actually just, like, hamstring it or just get their piece of the pie, you know. You'd need to dig into the specifics, and I haven't done that.
Yeah.
Do you know what, yeah, is it are the laws, like, reasonable, or are they terrible, you know?
I'm not exactly sure, and I'm not sure if that's actually open either. But I guess providing a regulatory framework for something acknowledges its existence and its legitimacy in society. So, for example, as bad as weed laws can be, right? As bad as that old nonsense can get, at least it's, like, not criminal. At least it's officially allowed in society, kind of thing. And of course, depending on your society, maybe it's better to have a black market than a white market, but that's a different topic altogether, I guess.
Yeah, well, there's an extent to which the state has a sort of sour grapes approach to regulation, mm-hmm. where, like, if the state is unable to regulate something, mm-hmm. the state tends to end up adopting the stance that it didn't want to, mm-hmm. right? Like, I think a big part of the fact that the war on drugs is ending is that the war on drugs was unsuccessful. And so it's not, and I'm not saying it's over, it's far from over, but certainly at least the war on pot seems to be winding down. You know, and part of that is because the war on pot didn't work. It's completely unsuccessful. And so, like, you know, having a bunch of laws on the books that are trivially disregarded and massively disregarded makes the state weaker. It's better that the state sort of evolve and say, well, we don't want to do that. Even if the state wanted to, then it continue to advance a stance that makes everyone aware of the fact that, hey, the state actually is not effective enough or powerful enough to do these things.
Yeah.
So one could say then the state is like any other actor in a free market system. It's responsive to market signals, except first off, they're really slow to respond to market signals, and they also have to be overwhelming market signals. It has to not just be like, well, you know, there's a growing demand for this. It's got to be like, literally, you're going to lose your power if you don't. It's just that, like, that threshold for responsiveness to market signals is like really high.
Yeah. And I will say this is also why I'm somewhat optimistic about cryptocurrency in the United States generally, is that, like, I think that some people who are critical of government make a epistemic mistake of, like, regarding the state as this, like, coherent entity that is, you know, going to advance the objectives of the state. And it's always better to, like, model anything as, like, in terms of the atoms, the individual people involved and the incentives that they have. And politicians' incentives are to be, you know, sort of spineless populists, right?
Yeah.
To follow what the people want. Even if the people want something that is bad for the state, if politicians have to believe or say that thing to get elected, then they generally will believe or say that thing. And so the more popular that Bitcoin and cryptocurrency gets, the more politicians will support it, even if cryptocurrency is a threat to, you know, the United States monetary regime or something like this.
Yeah. So, and that's an interesting, I mean, obviously for a more political type show, it'd be an interesting topic is, I mean, a democratic system, a representative democratic system makes government more sensitive to market needs, but at the same time makes it less sensitive in some ways. Whereas, like, if you have a dictator, they don't have that, those constant million pressures, but they do have the one big pressure. They're much more likely to, you know, hey, I'm going to make the whole society, for example, crypto friendly, if it's a dictatorship, it just to attract new whatever, whereas it's much more slow moving through the democratic process, even though that's more, more likely, like, to be sensitive.
Let's say that the, like, chairman of the Federal Reserve actually do regard blockchain as a threat to the United States financial system, right? They can attempt to educate politicians, and politicians do have, you know, a lot of them do have a, at least in their own sense, they feel that they're, like, these civically minded people who want the country and America to do well. Like, and so to some extent, they may sometimes, you know, not listen to the people and listen to the sort of more, let's say that they're the elite class, whether they deserve that label or not. You know, but it's not clear to me by what mechanism, like, the people running the Federal Reserve can, like, get a politician to do their bidding. Like, you know, and so if, like, if the constituency of the politician really wants something, why is the politician going to side with the Federal Reserve and not their constituency?
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. So about Cuba specifically with this whole thing, there's two potential angles to this. One is, as you mentioned, the sort of U.S. or petrodollar, whatever you call it, the global financial hegemony that they're pushing back against, or rather that they've been screwed by because of, like, sanctions and things like that, that they're trying to find an alternative to that. And this is, like, the only alternative, really. Or is it more of a El Salvador is doing it, like, all these different countries are trying to attract stuff, and they're just like, well, we want to keep up too with the new global financial revolution type thing? Or is it a mix of both? What do you think?
Yeah, that's a great question. And my honest answer would be that I really don't know, but that I can continue to speculate, like, anyway. But my honest answer would be, like, I would need to do some sort of, like, deeper dive. I will say that it is true. Like, human beings are faddish, and they copy one another and they follow one another. And this is true at even even the smartest, you know, most accomplished people behave that way, right? Like I see venture capitalists behave this way all the time, where it's like they're following the herd, this herd mentality. It's human nature.
Yeah.
And so the fact that El Salvador has sent this really strong signal, I'm sure that that has had an impact where, you know, that people are going to shift their perspective towards that way, and especially those that are in the circle with whoever in El Salvador like advanced or made that decision, right? Or whoever's adjacent to them or paying attention to them. And so it absolutely is possible that plays a role. And I don't know is El Salvador and the United States, are they friendly, or is there animosity between those two countries? I actually know very little about their relationship.
I would believe, I don't know specifically either, but I'm pretty sure they're relatively friendly. I mean, the U.S. government tends to be friendly with, you know, all of Western Europe and Latin America for the most part, with a few exceptions, right?
Wasn't El Salvador like literally using the dollar as its currency before this?
And I think it's still used. So, for example, in the Bitcoin law thing, if any merchant doesn't want to take Bitcoin, they have the option to cash out to USD and through a government government provided solution and stuff. So they are kind of using the US dollar, you know? And so,
yeah. So why, what's the, I don't even know who El Salvador's leader is. What
guy called Bukele, who has laser eyes on his Twitter profile. And he also like sent the army into the legislature to like intimidate for a vote and stuff like that. So he's a little, I don't know.
Yeah, no, I am aware that the law was, that he's fairly dictatorial and that the law was sort of passed in a dictatorial fashion. Mm-hmm. And certainly I think, you know, merchants should obviously have the choice as to what they want to take. But
yeah, of course.
I'm wondering like, is that, that's interesting. It's interesting. I wonder how much like, that's motivated by him like simply having gotten turned on to cryptocurrency and like owning it and holding it and like it being self-interested in that way, or if it's more like that he wants to somehow, because it is like at least a little bit like you know, sticking your thumb in the eye of the US, right, where you're saying like, you know, because you're kind of saying, oh, well, maybe you're flirting with Bitcoin a little bit and becoming your national currency instead of the dollar.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is just, I think that they realize that their own currency is just not going to cut it. And that's why they had the dollar to begin with. And it just, rather than that, which they are kind of owned by another country to a certain extent because of that, now they'd rather have like sovereignty because of crypto. But also, I think it's a great, like, you always want to attract foreign investment in your country. And so, especially if you got like a nice, you know, tropical country or whatever, you will Bitcoin Beach and all this stuff. If you want to just say, I mean, you don't just say like, oh, everyone has to take this stuff so tourists can come and pay for stuff. But also, if you just say like, oh, we're going full in with this, laser eyes, we're airdropping Bitcoin to every citizen, all this kind of stuff. Oh, and we're using like volcanoes to do power mining farms and all, like a lot of this stuff is getting a little bit like out there, but it's very like signaling to crypto is a big industry. It's going to be the big industry, at least. Come here and build your business here and give us all this tax revenue because we're going to have a favorable tax structure around there. Build up our country. Thank you. It seems pretty, especially like it's a teeny country. I mean, it's like a few million people. Like,
yeah.
It's like, you know, Maine, Vermont, New Hampshire, and like a little teeny bit of Mass, maybe.
That makes sense from a signaling perspective.
Yeah, just like get in foreign investment. So, yeah. I mean, this point kind of segues into the next thing, but like, well, we're talking about the hegemony, and it's interesting how a lot of Latin American countries have started to explore this kind of new system. And it seems like because the US has that, like the dollar, it doesn't really want to explore something like that because they're already number one, right? So do you think we're going to see a crypto versus USD kind of standoff as far as, you know, the monetary regimes on countries, kind of like a gold versus silver standard back in the day?
Yeah, I do. Not necessarily Bitcoin, but I think, I mean, certainly it could be Bitcoin. I'm not saying it's not going to be Bitcoin. And I guess from a certain logical sense, Bitcoin is the most logical candidate to be what it would be. But yeah, I mean, and this isn't actually because I think that, like, I actually don't think it's necessarily like harmful or bad for El Salvador's economy to be conducted in the US dollars. Like, the US has a strong economy, like tethering yourself to the US is not necessarily bad. If the US was, you know, managing its currency well, and here, even here, I'm probably less extreme than extreme is the wrong word. I'm like, my position isn't as strong as some Bitcoiners. Like, I'm not like a fan of the Federal Reserve, but I don't think it's like a complete travesty either. But it's still like, nonetheless, like, I think it's the case that the current design of the Federal Reserve, like, can be improved upon. And one of the improvements may just be having it be entirely algorithmic or having it be entirely fixed. I think that's possible. I am like, I don't know if this is the right place to take the conversation. I mean, I think there are plausible arguments to have some mechanisms by which the amount of currency in circulation can be shrunk or grown dynamically in response to certain market shocks or things like this, largely because contracts are denominated in fixed units of currency. And so like if the currency can't do this, you need to handle it like in each contract. Because it is true that you can have shocks that change the sort of real price of goods. And so there's an argument that you can allow your currency system to manage that. If your currency system is all fixed units, then you're going to want your contracts to have, you know, if I'm signing some contract, you know, for 20 years or something, you know, like, I don't really know what the real value of that currency is going to be in the future when it's fixed. And so you're going to actually have to write the contract in a way that adjusts based off of the way that the overall economy has grown or changed.
Yeah. I mean, that might be an interesting application for, let's just say, a stablecoin type thing. And not like, stablecoin today means like even faker fiat. Like, stablecoins today are trash. But in a future where you could imagine a, you know, something is pegged to a basket of goods or valuations or whatever, and you just say, you know, this is, you know, this contract is for this long-term contract, right? Is for this amount of, let's just assume Bitcoin is the one that wins. This much Bitcoin adjustable to the whatever, basically can be paid this amount of Bitcoin worth of this stablecoin kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that approach, that basket of goods approach to a cryptocurrency, I find it to be like the most promising one for these types of, you know, if you want something to potentially be this reserve currency or to actually be used as a as money. I think it's the coolest, but the most, I think, well, cool is I don't know if it's cool. Cool probably is like, I'm saying it's cool because I think it's like, it makes the most logical sort of sense. And David Friedman talked about this all the way back in the 1970s, he's a great economist. And he talked about what a free market for currency would look like. And this was well before blockchain. And he basically said, you know, exactly this, that in a free market for currency, you would see currencies coupled with commodities, and you would likely see currencies that go across a wide variety of currencies. So, you know, you can have one unit of this currency that corresponds to, you know, some amount of gold and some amount of silver and some amount of computer chips and some amount of corn and, you know, all of these things, and that it's actually a coupon, you know, for all of these things. And so, and you can use that as a money.
Yeah. And also, as far as like, if it's something like a Bitcoin or whatever, it's pretty, people want all their money in it because it's, again, in the future, not currently, but like a stable store of value. And because people know it's not being tampered with the value of the supply and things like that. So they're going to use that, and they're going to price goods and services in it. And like, if the price fluctuates in the course of a day, I don't think a lot of people are going to reprice their goods. If it's the unit of count, people are probably going to reprice their goods and services in it. In that, it only matters over a longer period of time. It's just that when you have these, I guess, longer term contracts? Because like, what happens if the price of Bitcoin doubles? I mean, and your salary is denominated in Bitcoin, you might have like a renegotiation a little bit, and then that's kind of like, that's fine. It's no big deal. It's just that if you have like some locked in long term contract, that's just all of a sudden you're like doing really well or doing really not well, you would probably want to put in some other stabilizing factors, you know?
Precisely, right? Like, we're happy to pay people in Bitcoin. We're not going to denominate your contract in Bitcoin, because if the price of Bitcoin goes way up, we're paying you too much. And the price of Bitcoin falls, guess what? You're going to either quit or you're going to want to renegotiate your contract. You're not going to continue working for one-fifth, the amount of money.
Yeah. It's funny because my, last 5 or so years I have worked, well, I guess almost 6 years by now, I have worked exclusively for a cryptocurrency, and about 70 to 80% of that has been non-USD denominated. It's been like, negotiated in a, USD price informed amount of cryptocurrency. But I have felt the effects, both very positive and very negative, of this is what I get paid, and then the price does something weird, and all of a sudden I'm like a baller, or all of a sudden I'm just like, all right, I guess I don't really need food, right? I guess I stored up enough over the winter.
Yeah. And, but we're, and that's very interesting. Were those ever like, multi-year contracts?
No, there were multi-month contracts, but I'm pretty sure we managed to always adjust every quarter. So,
but
that's also because the valuations of cryptos change incredibly, like 10 or 20% fluctuation in the course of a day. I mean, even for Bitcoin, the big daddy, can happen, even though that's a little rare, but like of any other smaller market cap coin, it's like in a single day, 20%, you kidding? Of course. So it's just that over time, it'll be that the quarterly might be a yearly thing. Like every year you renegotiate your salary based on whatever.
And of course, like, as the currency does get used for more real world transactions, like if somehow you flip the switch and all of a sudden the world economy was being conducted denominated in Bitcoin, you wouldn't see swings, right? You wouldn't
see, at least.
Well, you'd see very, they'd be almost imperceptible. Like, I think you'd struggle to get 1% absent some like huge shock where people are actually changing their time horizon and their time preference.
Yeah, of course.
Because it's like, there's no money. There's no, everything's being transacted in Bitcoin. Where's the excess money to, if the whole world was sharing one currency, was all, the only speculation in the currency itself would be basically bets over the time horizon, where you're saying that like in the future, I think it's an estimate of future productivity in the direction that it's going. That'd be the only bet that you could take, and any amount of money that people would even have to take those kinds of bets would be dwarfed by the overall volume of transactions that are happening.
Well, that's for sure. Now, so sort of rolling it back a little bit to the global financial hegemony topic thing, about it seems like there's a lot of countries are going to want to create like a competing standard, or they're going to be on the crypto standard as opposed to the Federal Reserve. And one thing that's a little bit in the opposite of that seems to be China. So, obviously this is not a high level geopolitical kind of a take, but it seems like, the U.S. is the hegemon currently. And if there was a counter, if there was the resistance, as it were, it's probably China. Russia tries to do, China is the other big one, right? So you'd think that China would be on board with this, like, the opposite's world. However, China, despite having almost all of the hashing power until very recently, has gone, taken kind of like the whole like China bans Bitcoin meme was a big thing for a while, but now it seems like they're actually like trying to be done with it. And supposedly they've doubled down on their crypto crackdown, saying that Bitcoin and other currencies are not real legal tender and have no value. And they're maintaining a high pressure situation on crypto. And they're trying to raise awareness for their people to stay away from crypto investments. They're basically the Chinese government, the CCP, as it were, seems to be trying to get out of crypto, like get crypto out of the country, which is kind of interesting from the hegemonic kind of status. So what do you think?
Yeah, so I think I think it's well, it's both like a smart and a stupid move. It's a stupid move because I don't think it will work. I don't have the best understanding of exactly how much control China has over the internet and its citizens. I gather it's substantially more than the United States.
Oh, yeah.
But to like what degree, you know, like is it like if it were feasible for China to actually eradicate cryptocurrency, it would probably be smart. Like, because the Chinese government, like that, it's a uniparty and it's predicated on control. So anything that's disruptive to it doesn't make sense to, you know, allow or tolerate. And China is vying with the United States. It doesn't need to make this more radical move of embracing blockchain. You're way more, I think, you know, you're way more likely to see a sort of like down the ranks country to make the kind of play of saying we're going to embrace blockchain. But I don't think it makes sense for China to be that country. China is very authoritarian. And so the idea that there would be a form of digital money that citizens can use to transact freely with, you know, makes sense to me that China doesn't like that. And given how my understanding, and I will say, like, I'm generally like pretty ignorant of China. So if I say something that's like grossly wrong, I apologize.
You're going to have to apologize alongside John Cena in Mandarin.
That you'll never see. but it's like, you know, if they're, you know, their payment systems and so on are like pretty strongly controlled by the government. So the idea of this like anonymous digital money or more freely moving, even if you know, digital money, that's intimidating, that's scary, that's disruptive to them. That's what their government is very good at, rooting things like that out and stopping it. You know, and so it makes sense to be, it makes sense from that view for them to be targeting cryptocurrency. Now, it also, now the only reason it doesn't make sense is that kind of sour grapes state perspective, where it's like, if the state can't actually achieve something, it's a mistake for the state to attempt to achieve it, because in failing, it showcases the state's weakness, right? And so it would be, from that sense, if China is not capable of controlling blockchain, then it's a mistake, because not only would blockchain succeed anyway, but it would then showcase to the Chinese citizens that, hey, the government failed to be able to do this, and it would give them confidence to, you know, some sort of subvert or disagree with their government.
Yeah, it does make perfect sense from a internal perspective of the government wants control over everything. People were using all that nonsense extra electricity from their power plants when they wanted to plan cities, and of course central planning just sucks, doesn't work out. And so they're like, all right, well, let's let these people like take over our mistake, and then a lot of money comes out of it. But then they realize, oh, this is not the right kind of stuff we want happening. We need to stop capital flight at all costs. We want to shut this down. Besides, we're doing our own digital stuff. So they want to shut that down. That makes perfect sense. The external thing makes less sense, but as you mentioned, like they think they're in a position that they can compete with a dollar, not that like they need some help competing with a dollar kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, I don't know if this is too much of an aside, but I've seen some decent arguments that like China's economy is not really that much more top down or centrally controlled than the United States is. Mm-hmm. And obviously China is relatively authoritarian in its economy, but so is the United States, right? If you look at the amount of money that's being spent by government, and all government spending is top down, right? It's all top down. So any dollar being spent by the government is a top down dollar. It wasn't bottom up through local coordination. It was the government took all this money and then went through a centrally planned process and then spent that money. Mm-hmm. And there's a guy, his name's I think Branko Milanovic or something close to this. He has a book called Capitalism Alone. Mm-hmm. And he argues that like if you actually attempt to measure what percentage of each economy is quote capitalism, and he says capitalism is just bottom up human economic coordination. Okay. It's kind of the definition that he gives, which others may have other definitions, but when he says capitalism, that's what he means. Mm-hmm. And he says that it's pretty comparable, that it's like 70% in both countries.
Interesting. I wonder, Like, I wonder where that comes from. Like, so here's the thing. It's pretty obvious that there's some parts of China's economy that are so much more controlled than the U.S. But it's funny how China's managed to retain a lot more economic freedom than should be possible considering the absolute totalitarian grasp they have on just about everything else. So that's always kind of a fascinating sort of a thing. Yeah. Now, the other thing, though, is I wonder how good our information sources are on exactly how free China is, as far as their economy, as far as their actual economic output. Like, I remember hearing Yeonmi Park doubting their official economic stats that they put out about all that kind of stuff. And of course, I doubt all the official numbers, you know, but yeah. Like, especially, like, I think I trust China's official numbers more than North Korea's, but not substantially. Yeah,
totally. And I'm not going to go to bat too hard for his analysis. I'm not smart enough. And this was, I'm a big fan of the podcast Econ Talk. Mm-hmm. And so this is just from catching an episode of Econ Talk where he was on. I haven't even read his book. But I just thought it was an interesting, you know, kind of idea, interesting argument. And I mean, I think, though, look, again, they're not dumb. It's a mistake to think that they're dumb. You know, and one of the actually most common, I don't know if it's the most common, a mistake that I think people make frequently is they think that people who share their inclinations are intelligent and people who have different inclinations are dumb. And I think that a better world to separate intelligence and inclinations. There can be people who are very intelligent who have the complete opposite of inclinations to you. If you're libertarian minded, independent, personal choice kind of, there are people who are just as smart as you, who are authoritarian minded, who say everything should be driven by authority, and it's all about the community. It's not about the individual, and you know, whatever the opposite of your inclinations are, right? Inclinations and intelligence are like generally separate phenomenon, in my opinion. And so there are very intelligent people in China, and they have a desire for a certain amount of control over their society. They think their society works better when people have to live in a certain amount of they would use a word like harmony or something, you know, where there's certain like similarities and certain things are forced and certain bad individualistic selfish choices are not allowed. But they're still smart enough to recognize that, hey, capitalism works and people need a self-incentive. People need that incentive to create things and to make things and to work, you know, a 70-hour week and a whatever it is, you know, to pour their heart into something. They need to take risks.
The system needs to be gamified to a certain extent.
Yeah, right. And so, you know, I think China used to be much more, basically communist economically authoritarian than it used to be. And the people there said, hey, we want to retain this authority in a lot of capacities, but we're actually better off letting the economy be a bit freer so long as we can retain certain, you know, authority over it.
Yeah, well, that's true. And I almost wonder if they would embrace crypto someday once it becomes kind of economically necessary. Again, not assuming it will in any near future, but in maybe a midterm future when a lot of the world just doesn't want meddled with currencies. They might just say, like, well, we're going to do this, but we're going to have certain, you know, regulations with this, that. We're going to have, like, super hardcore blockchain analytics stuff. We're going to, like, ban use of self-hosted wallets, just like, you know, the U.S. is trying to do now. Like, it might just be one of those things where they come full circle, but I think they felt like they were losing control and they had to get it back more.
I think you're exactly, No, I think you're exactly right. And I think that it's not that they're like, it's about the control of the economic transactions. So if they could control the software layer, right? So you could only use, you know, official wallets and, you know, and they could see what you were doing, you know, that kind of thing. They'd be fine with it.
Yeah. Well, it seems like a pretty good time to start wrapping this thing up. Anything awesome and exciting you have going on other than just, you know, fighting for freedom as usual? Anything else you want to shout out in a,
let's see. I don't know. Odyssey's been continuing to blow up. Numbers are like higher almost every day and every week. And that definitely feels very good. Hopefully going to finally get to court in the near future and looking to you know, really, really finally reaching that moment. I'm going out to Budapest in a couple of weeks to this conference called Brain Bar.
Okay.
So I'll be honest, I'm a little nervous about traveling internationally because leaving New Hampshire was hard enough for me. But it should be fun. It seems like a good crowd of people. I'm going to be trying to meet some crypto people while I'm out there. I'm probably going to try to stop in the UK as well, because there's an announcement there coming out soon. I can't tell you, but there is a big fund announcement for Library that's related to the UK in the near future.
Interesting.
I'm hoping to stop over there as well. And so I don't know if anyone's listening and it will be at Brain Bar or be in Hungary or is in the UK in September. Mm-hmm. You can connect me to people, and I'd be interested in meeting, you know, blockchain and cryptocurrency people out there.
Yeah. Well, fantastic. Do you want to recommend people follow you on Twitter, or is that just sort of like?
No, there, people can follow me on Twitter. It's my full name, Jeremy Kaufman. And you should follow Odyssey Team and Library as well.
Yeah. And I do like, I kind of do like the clarity, the personal clarity of like, a lot of people have these like illusions about like what they do in life, like what it matters or whatever. But I definitely like what is in your bio where it says building us out of our modern dystopia, which honestly should kind of, it's a very succinct encapsulation of where we all are or going to, and what we all should be doing with our time if we can. So, yeah.
Yeah. Cheers. Right on. You're doing it too. So yeah, kudos to you.
Well, cheers to that. Definitely like, comment, share, subscribe, all that kind of stuff. Follow on Odyssey if you can. Some people are saying, oh, degraded performance sticker on the thing or whatever, but I don't know. It is what it is. Odyssey will be smoother than YouTube consistently at some point. So you guys just got to keep trying. So yeah. So cheers to that. Let me hit the end graphic and I'll see you guys next week. Or if you're on going to watch the Dash podcast, which I run immediately after this, if you are watching on Odyssey, you don't have to even click out of the link. It's the same link. I'm just going to do the next one on it. So if you're on YouTube, you'll have to actually like wait for a YouTube video pop up because YouTube sucks, but whatever. All right. Bye-bye, guys. Thanks so much for listening. If you enjoyed the podcast, subscribe so you don't miss an episode, and donate to support the show by going to my Cointree page. That's cointr.ee/thedesertlinks, and leave a message with your donation. Check out the show's sponsors. Live on Crypto with BitRefill. Buy absolutely anything with crypto with Shop and Bit. Avoid content censorship with Odyssey. Protect your privacy online with NordVPN. Get paid to search with Presearch. All links are in the show notes.